Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. In cooperation with the Institute for Holocaust Education, we'll hear a talk by Judy Mizell, Holocaust survivor and civil rights activist. Mrs. Mizell will tell her story of miraculously escaping the gas chamber during the Holocaust and her interactions with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the civil rights movement. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 13, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Beth Selden Doton, Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
We have been so fortunate over the past number of years at the Institute for Holocaust Education to work with documentary filmmakers who put together this amazing film about Judy Mizell and her life story. And under different circumstances, we would have had you all watch that film first, but everything happened so fast. Today, Judy is here. She has been speaking. She spoke to Lincoln High, Lincoln Southwest High, Pound Lux Middle in Lincoln. Today she spoke at DC West Middle School and Westside Middle School, and she was at Duchenne last week, and she'll be speaking at Burke tomorrow. So just the impact of her story is really amazing here in Omaha and all over the United States. The documentary, if you are interested in it, I can certainly help you acquire that anytime. But I'll tell you a little bit about Judy, and then she's going to tell her story. And I think wants questions from you so that it's a dialogue more than anything today. But Judy was born in Lithuania and moved to a small town or a larger town called Kovno and spent time in the Kovno ghetto once World War II began in Lithuania. And shortly after was taken to a concentration camp, Stutthof concentration camp, where she witnessed many very, very difficult and horrific things that she'll tell you about. But in addition to that, she was on a death march, worked, she fled from the death march and worked for the Wehrmacht under hidden identity, and ultimately ended up in Denmark, where all the Jews had been saved to Sweden, and she stayed in Denmark until the end of the war, and I'll let her tell the rest of that story. So thank you again for being here, and there is no doubt in my mind that you will walk away having a new friend and feeling a very, very special afternoon here. So thank you. Turn it on.
Can you hear me? Yeah. It's just a pleasure to be here, and thank you for coming out and this beautiful Santa Barbara weather here. And you had a little bit of Santa Ana wind here, too. And if the above was very good to me. I was here in, what is it, 203, and I was stuck in Lincoln for 3 days. I was here for 5 days because it was such a big blizzard. I couldn't get to Creighton in time, but they brought me there. It's incredible. You can ask me any question you want. Beth already said some of it. Think I don't have that much time. I would like to have that we have a dialogue. What's happened now? What's happening now? What happened to me as a Jew? I'm Jewish. I'm the youngest of three children. We were a religious family, and we lived in a little town in Lithuania called Jasvina. Then my father passed away before the Russians came in and won't give me time to speak about that. And then my mother moved to Kaunas with us so she could get work. She was a seamstress. And then the war broke out. And first the Russians occupied Lithuania, and then Nazi Germany moved in. It was very bad during Stalin. The religion was not allowed, and the Jewish schools were closed, but things were getting worse day by day, and we couldn't imagine imaginable. I remember hearing all the adults listening to a man coming from Poland and saying, they're burning Jews in Poland. They're setting a fire at the synagogues. They're burning, putting the people in the synagogue and burning it. And everyone said, the adults, at that time I was 11 years old, he's senile. How can Germans, an educated country, the most educated country in the world, do this? Burn people like that alive? We didn't believe it. We couldn't believe it because it was Germany, because it was the most educated country in the world. There was no illiteracy in Germany. There were more illiteracy here, but there was no illiteracy in Germany, really. And so, before long, the Germans were there. They arrested us, and they put us in the Kovno ghetto, suffocating with barbed wire surrounded. We didn't know what was happening. Typhus broke out right away, and I'll never forget about the hospital, that there were so many people in the hospital, and the nurses and the doctors and all, and it was burned. And they set it afire with the people in it. I remember standing there with my mother, and my mother said, no, we can't stand here. We got to go back where we lived. We lived in a house that was four families at that time in the house, with three bedrooms, no indoor plumbing, no heating. The water we had to go out and get from the well, pump the water, and food became scarce, and that's how we lived. We lived like that for 4 years. And I'm rushing through the whole thing because I want questions afterwards. So then my mother, since she was a seamstress, and she was a very good seamstress, she was 39 years old, she got a job, and she made dresses. She didn't know who she was making, but the commandant, they took her in, and they sent her to Germany, the dresses. And so she had evidently access. She asked for us to give us cards so we could go to work, and she felt that if we go to work and we're not in the ghetto, we will live. Because in the ghetto, every day proclamations came through, one day after the other, to bring children from infant to 6 years old, and they didn't come back into a... Can you imagine mothers dropping off their children and then knowing that they're not going to come back? And then the older children, and then the older people, and the older men, and they were all not coming back. And then there was a Fort 9 that they were taking them. After a while, we found out, the older people, and we could hear them, the shooting all night long, and screaming and shooting, and this went on almost daily. And the three cards that she brought, so we wouldn't be there in the ghetto. We worked in Inkeris factory making boots for the German army, slave labor. And then for that we got a little bit of soup, and in the soup they put in some peelings of potatoes, carrots, or whatever, and that was our food. And we would get an extra bowl of soup. We would work from 6 in the morning till 6 at night, and we had to, it took us almost an hour to get there running in the street. We were not allowed to walk on the sidewalk to Inkeris. When I was there to make the film, the company was still in existence, and they were making boots for Adidas. And the filmmakers wanted to go up and film there, and they came right down. I said, what happened? How come you didn't... They said, we thought we were choking to death. And can you imagine working with rubber all day long? The stench, and it was just unbelievable. I didn't go up because I know what I could remember the smell. And that's what we did. Then one day we were asked to assemble on a big field, and we were taken onto trucks, and we were taken, drove for 2 days. And when they opened up the trucks, well, we were like sardines packed in. Half of the truck, the people were dead. And then we were taken to a place at Königsberg at this train station, and all I could see was the light. From the darkness, we went into this huge light beams, and they stood there and watched. So the commandants all with their spiffy blue uniforms and their boots and their riding boots and pushing us off the trucks into the, to the, it wasn't really a train, it was like a cattle train, and no place to sit down. And we were pushed together. There were already people there, not sitting, standing. And then we went, and they took us to Stutthof concentration camp. When we went into the concentration camp, a woman by the name of Irma Greta came out and said, "Nobody comes out alive from here." We immediately had to get dressed, undressed, and then a woman who I became a little friendly with, when she took off her dress, a little baby fell out, and he took the baby's little arm and threw it against the asphalt. And the baby screamed. Whenever I talk about it, I can hear it. And then my mother had gold teeth. In those part of the world, gold teeth was very, a lot of people had it. They took, ripped out the gold, and then they even examined us to see if we were hiding diamonds or gold or whatever it is. And then I had beautiful long blonde hair locks. When I was younger, they would call me Shirley Temple with long locks, and they tore it out, one on each side. And the man said, "I'm taking some of those beautiful locks to my daughter for her puppy, for her doll." And I couldn't understand what's happening. I asked my mother, "Why are they doing this?" And she says, because we're Jewish. And when we went into the barrack, they gave us a striped dress with a number on the dress, with a yellow star with written Yude on. And then they gave us a pair of clogs. My sister to this day said, "You didn't have it so bad because you had the right and left clogs." I had two right clogs. Well, it's not laughing matter when you have to walk with two right wooden clogs. And then we went into the barrack. The barrack was made up with bunk beds, but it weren't bunk beds like we see them here, with slots, and there was a mattress with straw, and then we had four people, sometimes five and sometimes three. If a person died, we had to take them out in front. And in front, we stood for appeal, which was for, so they can, they called it appeal for when they would take people and take them to the gas chamber or take them to work or whatever it is. And then they told us that the latrines will be open twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening. And typhus is dysentery. If you made yourself messed up, then you immediately got a bullet in your head and it killed you because it's very contagious. And that was their big fear. And as many people, I think, as from the gas chamber, this is how many people died of typhus. And then they told us that when we got in, we got this dish. It was so rusty that somebody else already had it. Every concentration camp and every ghetto was self-sufficient with all the things that they took from the people. They didn't spend a penny. With all the loot that they got from all of what they stole and what they got away with. That's what that, and the trains to Auschwitz and to Stutthof and all the other concentration camps. What the only thing the German people will tell me, I've spoken to many Germans, those are the only ones that went on time. The rest of it you never could count if they were going on time, but that went on time, and it didn't cost it that. And they, some of times, they charged people if they felt that they needed the money they had to get right away in the very beginning from the people that they took in Germany. And then one day as we stood there, my mother was taken to the gas chamber. She didn't know where she was going. She was standing with me and she said, "I don't want you to come with me." And I said, "No, I want to go with you." And then we went in and we got undressed. And when I think of my mother, who was a beautiful woman, very religious, had to get undressed in front of those beasts. But they weren't beasts, that I could say. They were human beings who were handsome, rather. Who are those people? They're also part of the creation of the above. Evil. How can they be so evil? And coming from a country that was so educated and gave the world so much and good things, like science. We wouldn't be in outer space if one of one born wouldn't have come here. And gave so much education and so much history, but they gave to the world. To have beasts like that who would do this because somebody is not who they are, of a different religion. It was difficult to understand. And that's what made it happen. And I feel to this day that only a country that was so educated like Germany could do it. It's made up of that. Because 80% to 90% went to say, "Hi, Hitler," and they were all bystanders. They didn't do anything. And when I talk to German people and they tell me I didn't know, it's a lie. They didn't want to do anything. They did it out of fear, probably. But they didn't do anything. They stood by and let a man who couldn't even fill out an entrance exam to a college to mesmerize a country like Germany to a point where 6 million Jews were killed, 1.5 million Jewish children, and 5 million others. 5 million, the 5 million who were not the same as the Jews. The Jews were made total annihilations, but the 5 million were arrested and were in camps and died of hunger and pestilence, of typhus and everything in the camps because they helped a Jew or a Roma. Those are the lessons that we have to learn. They risk their lives to do it, and they'll risk their families' lives to save another life to a Jew or a Roma, a gypsy family. Those are the lessons that we have to learn. Or the neighbor next door who didn't go to the Gestapo to say there's something happening in that house. I'm sure they know there was something, because they were also hungry, and they could get 100 kilo potatoes and a ham if they went in and they told them this was happening. And this went on until right after my mother was taken. And I went with her to the gas chamber. I was already with 1 foot in. And the man started screaming, "Heraus, you Schweinhunde!" And I was so numb. My mother pushed me and screamed lay feud in Iran, and I'm glad the next this sentry didn't see me, who was the guard, who was guarding on top, because he could have shot me. And then I got another address from a corps that they were taking out the dresses, and they told me to run to your barrack quickly. And then I hid for 2 days. After that, we were evacuated, and the death marches started. You know, we talk about, a lot of you are teachers, we talk about Anne Frank, and the schools, all the in the schools, they all read the diary, most of them. Anne Frank is the most famous Jewish child. There was at least 500,000 Anne Franks who we'll never know about. If Miep Gies, may she rest in peace, who died last year, if she did not hit the Frank family, and I have suspect who gave the Anne Frank family away. Nobody ever was arrested because they say you don't know, but they know. Helen was good, but Helen's jewelry paid a hard price. Only 7% of the Dutch jewelry survived, which isn't a great, a lot. We think about Holland as a wonderful country, and it is a wonderful country, because Anne Frank made it very famous. But if Miep Gies did not find that diary, you would never have known about Anne Frank. And there was at least 500,000 Anne Franks. We will never know what the world would be today. So when the death march came, 1,500 women, there were 86,000 Jewish women in Stutthof concentration camp, according to the museum in Washington. And only 6% survived of that. And when we went out on the death march, I kept saying my sister had typhus and she was just beginning to get a little better. And I kept saying, we're going to live, you must go, because they said, if you can't walk, we will take you, you can stay there, but we knew what would happen. And all of a sudden, as we were walking, the sky opened up. Heavy bombardment, the Russians were bombing the place. And I said, when I was in Stutthof, to the curator, now they're all museums, I said, why did they bomb us when we could barely walk? And he said, because the Russians, they thought that we were troop movements. And to take us to the Umschlagplatz, and we went into a house, and then the woman, it's like she knew that we were coming, gave us some clothes, took the lice-infested striped dresses we were wearing, and then gave us some food and gave us some water. And then she told the Russian who worked for her, who was a prisoner of war, to take us to the Umschlagplatz, where they took all the women, the 1,500 women, and they put them on barges on the ice, and they shot them all. I didn't know what happened to those 1,500 women. I didn't know. I know they went to the Umschlagplatz because that's what the woman said to take us there. But let me tell you, about 10 years ago, the New York Times had a major article about the women in Stutthof, those 1,500 women that went out. The 1,500 women that went out that were killed. A man was going, that's what in the winter, and we didn't know if it was, we knew it was winter, and we knew it was summer, but we didn't know, because we had no radio, no communication whatsoever. So for us, it was, we didn't know, but we knew that it was the week of Christmas, because we saw the Christmas trees in the people's home. So we know it was Christmas. And when we went to make the film, we wanted to go to the Umschlagplatz to find out. And we knew it was in Königsberg, but it was a Russian naval base, and we couldn't do it. They wouldn't allow us to do that. But a man went when the summer, when the ice was thawing, and he saw a lot of bodies lying on the ice. And it's a very isolated place. And he was on a horse, so he came and he notified the people, and they took as many corpses as possible, and they buried it there. And then they put a monument up. The Russians wouldn't do it, but they finally did it. And in the beginning, the Russians were there, but now the Russians are not there. It was part of East Germany, Königsberg. And they put up a monument. So New York Times were there to take pictures of the monument and then talk about, you know, what happened. It was a 2-page article about it. I was in Auschwitz 4 years ago with 8,000 students, Jewish students from all over the world. And I was on staff. And the curator came to me, someone introduced her, and she said she was so happy that she met somebody from Stutthof. And she said, "Tell me, when did you leave Stutthof?" And I said, "It was during the week of Christmas, because we could see the Christmas tree in people's homes." And she said, "Look on page 6 in your blue book." And she says, "It says 1,500 women went out and only 13 survived." And I said, "Well, I'm one of the 13, and my sister." And she said, "Yes. And what's your name?" And I gave her the name. She looked it up, and it's enough. They know. Because Auschwitz was a satellite of, Stutthof was a satellite of Auschwitz. The Russian soldier said, "I'm not going to take you to the Umschlagplatz. I'm going to take you to the nearest Platz in the Weichsel, which is the Vistula River, the nearest, and then you can just go at night and call on all your force, if you can do that. I'll slide with your buttocks, and then you'll cross over." It was frozen. When I went there to make another film beside the film I talked that Spielberg sent me, at that time, we went exactly during the week of between Christmas and New Year. It was not frozen. And that year of, this was 1944, was the coldest of coldest winters there was ever. And I want to tell you that I think Hitler lost the war because of the winter. It was so severe. And then the soldier told us that if we go, the first one we should try a convent. So we went to the convent, and the convent, the nuns were wonderful. And he said, "Don't tell anyone you're Jewish. You're Lithuanian, and you're from the Elbe," because they were fighting there a lot. The Russians and the Germans, they came in. And they knew right away we were Jewish, and they took good care of it. They took and washed my head and gave us food and nursed us back. After a week, they said to us, "You have to convert." They gave us the rosaries, and they said, "You have to convert. We can't keep you." And I found out not too long ago why they couldn't. They said that. It's a very interesting thing. And maybe in the questions it'll come out. And one thing, if you leave and they find you and they torture you, you're liable to say where you were now, and they'll arrest us too. So they used to lock us up. So we opened up a window and we called out, because we only wanted to survive as Jews. We thought we were the only one in the world left. We had no idea what was happening in the rest of the world. And if we survive, Only we wanted to survive as Jews. Nothing else mattered. So when we went out, we met another Russian soldier, because the Russians they liberated the whole area. And then I got very sick, and I had typhus. So he left me. My sister, he told to go over a bridge, and she went back and found a Wehrmacht station where they get their ammunition and they get their food and that. And I said to her, did you know that? She said, no. They would keep me there and we could work. And then she came back for me. They left me on the steps of the hospital and they took me in. And then after I got better, she took us back, and it was terrible being there with the woman. She had 9 children. She would beat us terrible every night. She would tie up our hands behind our back, and we had to, like dogs, entertain her 9 children. Her husband was an SS official. She was just a horrible, horrible person. And then one day she came, she said, we are leaving, because they're going to let everything underwater. It's going to be flooding because it's a very important port, Danzig. And we sailed for Denmark. And as soon as we got into that boat, it was torpedoed. And I don't swim to this day. And we were held up on planks. And we finally came to Denmark. And I owe my life to the Danish people. If anybody here is Danish, well, let me tell you, you are a holy people, but you did. They literally saved the entire Jewish population. For 3.5 years, they did not touch the Jews. And nobody wore a star to point them out as Jews. Not the king. The king never wore a star. So a lot of people say, when I come to Denmark, say, please tell your Americans, nobody wore a star. Because we say if you put a mark on a person, then you're done. And they owe my life because they gave me the most incredible thing. For 2.5 years, I was in the hospital. I weighed 47 pounds. I was 16 years old in Söllerau Sanatorium. And they took such good care of me. And I had no insurance. And I want to tell you, I owe my life because they gave me my self-esteem as a human being and this sense of trust. And a couple by the name of Paula and Sven Jensen introduced us and made a family for us from all the other Danes. They would come every day on the bicycles to come to Söllerau Sanatorium, for they lived in Antagensvej, which is a long, long way to be with us. And I owe my life to her. My hair grew back because she took me to every doctor possible to get it growing back. And that's my story. My brother survived Dachau, and we found each other. And I went to Canada. And from Canada, I got married and then moved to United States. In the United States, I sat and watched the news one night. And my favorite reporters were Jan Chancellor and David Brinkley. I don't know if anybody here is old enough to remember. They were the best pair that I would listen to news to. And I saw a mob of people in Philadelphia in Folkhoft, which is near the airport. It's a blue-collar place. It's not even a nice place. It's all row houses. And an African-American family moved in by the name of Baker, and everything became chaos. A mob of people taunted them and wrote horrible things on their house. The police stood there and did nothing. And for me, it was very scared, because for me, it was like Kristallnacht, with the broken glass, and where they burned all the books and our Torahs and everything. And then I figured I have to do something about it, so I baked some cookies, and I went to see the Bakers, Sarah and Horace Baker. And I told them, I'm Jewish, I'm a Holocaust survivor, what can I do for you? So they were very worried about the children. We took both children to a Quaker family who had the same age, the Taylors, and their children. And I became involved in the civil rights movement very much. I met the Reverend Martin Luther King. I had dinner with him in a hot private home. And I worked very hard on the March on Washington. And for me, I did it for my children, my grandchildren. I felt if an African-American home is not secure, then my Jewish home is not secure either. And to me, Martin Luther King became my hero. Why? Because he was so interested. When I met him there, he came to Philadelphia to see what he can do with the unions, because the unions were not integrated. And when he died in Memphis, he went for the sanitation people who worked for the sanitation department to integrate them into the unions. And that's when he was killed. And to me, he did more for the white people than he did for African-American. He broke the shackles of indifference, taught whites what it is, and peaceful coexistence. That's what he wanted. Non-violence, he taught. And so, to me and my kids, he became my hero. General Eisenhower is another hero that to me was. Because how many of you have been to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum? Okay. When you get off that elevator, there's a big sign from Eisenhower, a beggar the day when there will be in this country, in our country or anywhere else, that the Holocaust didn't happen. I was eyewitness. He called in Patton to be eyewitness, and that Ordruf was the first camp who was liberated, concentration camp that was liberated. He called them in to be eyewitness. And today there are deniers who say this did not happen. There's also deniers who are in academia, in universities, who are deniers who are saying the same thing. And this, to me, I'm not going to let them kill me a second time with lies. So now I would like to ask you questions, if there is time. Is that time, Beth? No?
Yes?
Yes? Okay. I'm glad. So ask him for questions if I can. Oh, okay.
I am wondering, do you know why, or was there a reason why, when you were with the group of 1,500 women from the concentration camp, and some of them were killed on a boat, right? And you weren't part of that group. Why were you kept out of that group?
Oh, I didn't talk about that. I was speaking so fast, she told me, cut out this, cut out that, so see what you do. We went into that home. That woman gave us this, and they started bombing. And everybody started running. The soldiers that were guarding us and everybody. And I had no attention, and my sister, who was in charge, to fall in. And my sister to this day says, you give that woman so much credit that she was so good. She gave us clothes, but she told the guy to take us to the Umschlagplatz. But with that dress, there was already on the radio, they were announcing that there was escaped people. If they see them, they should shoot them right away because they're all sick with typhus and they'll spread typhus. So I escaped that way.
Did you say a Russian helped you, brought you to the convent?
Not at the convent. The Russian soldier was in that lady's place. He was a Kriegsgefanger. He was taken in the war.
Oh, a prisoner.
A prisoner of war. Yeah. There was somebody there from England, too. They captured. They had most of the people that captured, they had them work in farms because the men were all at war in Germany. There were a lot of the prisoner of war who worked in the farms.
being of Danish ancestry, thank you.
Oh, yes.
My grandmother came over from Denmark.
Oh, yes.
But I'm interested in what part of Denmark that
I
you
live?
Spent time, yes.
I was in the hospital in Solerød Sanatorium, which they fed me because my stomach was so strong. I was there for 2.5 years. And I lived in Hellerup and Charlottenlund. That's a suburb of, I lived with some people in Denmark. And if you, your mother alive? Is your mother alive?
No, my grandmother.
Your
grandmother. No.
Yeah.
Was that on the Jutland Peninsula or was that on the main?
No, it was Copenhagen. You took the train about an hour from Copenhagen.
Okay.
Yeah.
You started to talk about deniers.
Deniers.
What should we say when we hear someone say that? They don't believe the Holocaust happened.
Well, if it is the most documented what happened to the Jewish people. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, for one. Eisenhower and the American Army, the people who liberated the liberators. I don't have to. It's beneath my dignity to tell them. It's the same thing, like the same people will say, there was never slavery in the United States. It's in the same thing. They deny it. And they want confrontation. And I'm not going to do that.
Right.
I have to tell you a very interesting thing. I was at a very large Catholic high school. It's the only one in Santa Barbara, Bishop Diego. And this happened quite a few years ago, but I don't know, 6, 7 years ago. I was speaking to them. I come in a couple of times a year to speak to them. This was in 11th grade. And I'm going out to the car, and this young man is running after me. And he said, Mrs. Meisel, I want to thank you for coming to our school. You saved my life. I said, how so? He said, I've been with the same kids since kindergarten. And now I'm in 11th grade, and we're in the same school, in the same classes, and I like them very much, but a couple of kids are Aryan Nation. They hate Latinos. They hate Jews. They hate African American. And we have to take initiation. I've only taken 2 initiations, but since I heard you, I'm not going to do it. And now Bill has graduated NYU and is a very prominent lawyer in New York. And to me, I really feel I saved his life, because not only his, but his grandparents and his parents, because they don't win. They are nobody. They're just taken. Hate, when you hate and you're so full of hate, do you know what? They don't survive. They eventually end up nothing. They just take up space.
Hi, Judy. Thanks for coming to College of St. Mary. We're really excited to have you. Can you tell us how old you were when you were in the gas chamber with your mom?
When I was working, I was already 15 years old. I went back to this gas chamber twice. I went in. I was looking what was in there, and let me tell you, I saw nothing but nails in the wall, fingernails. That's how it was, so horrible. I was looking for my mother's fingernails. I would recognize.
With Viktor Frankl's book, he talks about kind of what he focused on while he was there. I was wondering if you could just share, like, what your thoughts were while you were in the concentration camp to just get you through.
It's interesting. I read that when it first came out, and I appreciate it more now when I read it about a couple of weeks ago when I was traveling. It's very interesting, because that's how did I survive? by living one second more. I would put myself in a trance, and we had a lot of nasturtium. And the smell of the nasturtium, I could even smell. It was so important to me. And I would think about that, and I would think about my mother baking challah for Shabbat and the important things. And I would put myself in a trance. And I have to tell you what he writes, which is therapy with Loga, he writes too, to you know, if you can't help yourself, but that we don't know how resilient our bodies are. We don't know until the last minute what happens when things happen to us, how we react. And every human being reacts differently. But nobody knows how each one of us is so resilient until that moment comes. And I don't know, did you get that through the book? It's logotherapy, I mean. But it's not, it's just each person has this inner feeling that we have. If you, there's one thing no one can take away from you, is hope and faith. Nobody can take that away. And nobody can take away your education from you. The most important thing, where would we be today without teachers? Where would we be? To me, the teacher is the most important person. But I don't think society realizes that. The backbone of in the United States is the educational system that we have. I know this is something that, you know, Catholics have their own schools and so forth. But the United States has that every child is entitled to an education. Nowhere else is happening. I mean, this is something that Denmark has it. Denmark has a good system. But the kind of system that the United States have, but what we have, to me, United States, it's the best country in the world. A man said to me last week, I was speaking in Ventura, and he's California, and he said to me, how can you say that? It's a backward country. And I said, why is it a backward country? It's fixable, United States. We can fix it. A lot of countries, you can't fix it. You're not allowed to fix it. And thank God that we live here. 14 years ago, I was discovered with cancer that was spread. They only thought I would live 2 months, and I'm here 11 years after. After I said 14, 11 years after. Because it came back, but 11 years that I have been free. So cancer is not a death sentence anymore. And because we live here in this country, with the know-how and everything, we have it.
We have time for one more.
Yes.
You said how educated Germany was. How is it, in your opinion, that a country that was so educated could get led by one person to do such horrible things to a race of people or a religious community? How could that happen?
Okay. I feel that a backward country could never have done it. This was done with the most educated people. The Einsatzgruppen 1 and Einsatzgruppen 2. There is a book out that it's called Hitler's Willing Executioners by Goldenhagen. He's a Harvard professor. The only thing that the book does is he says all of Germany. There were a small group in Germany. There was the White Rose who were arrested, but they, you know, protested and so forth. He killed them off too and so forth. They were Germans. I feel that they could only do it because they were so educated, and that's what's so scary. That's what's so scary, what it can happen. with lies. He promised prosperity. It was right after World War I. The reparations were on that they had to pay. He promised them a Volkswagen in each home. The Volkswagen, the first Volkswagen that came out, the hubcap was a swastika. And they promised that. And when you have, when you don't have anything, and you're destroyed and everything, and this man comes, I want to finish this, that the most important thing to me is that we respect each other's difference. There is no one religion that is more superior to the next. We all have our faiths, and we all practice our faiths, and in which we love ourselves, but when that doesn't mean that we are better than someone else. We're all human beings made in the above image. A man by the name of Reinhold Neumüller, an Episcopalian minister who was head of the Free Church, he said when the Nazis, and he was a thorn in Hitler's side, he was arrested for 8 years. He went through terrible times, and this is what he said: when they first came for the communists, I was not a communist, so I didn't object. Then when the Nazis came after the trade unionists, I was not a trade unionist, so I didn't object. When they came after the Jews, I was not a Jew, so I didn't object. And then when they came after some Catholics, I was not a Catholic, so I didn't object. And then when they came after me, there was no one else to object. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum, presented in cooperation with the Institute for Holocaust Education. We've heard a talk by Judy Mizell, Holocaust survivor and civil rights activist. She has told her story of miraculously escaping the gas chamber during the Holocaust and her interactions with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. during the civil rights movement. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 13, 2010, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Carmen Steele, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.